For the last 2.5 years, I've taught band, choir, percussion, and general music to middle and high schoolers at Columbus North International School, which is just 2 or 3 miles south of here on High Street. Once every 2 weeks or so, I set aside my curriculum and teach something else: deep, compassionate listening. Formally, these are known as restorative justice listening circles. When we have circle days, as my students call them, we use a set of shared guidelines and values that each class makes. Guidelines are things like speak openly, listen deeply, use the talking piece, keep your phone away, and the most important, what is said here stays here, what is learned here leaves here. In some procedural ways, it's like a covenant group. But if you're picturing me in the role of facilitator, erase that image. Once they're comfortable, students take the initiative to run the circles. I'm just another participant, an equal. I've been making time for circles for 1.5 years, so returning students are pretty comfortable with the format by now. Many of our circle topics are predictable: goal setting at the beginning of the year, reflection after a concert, that sort of thing. Others arise spontaneously, prompted by the presidential election, the need for the rest of the class to hear the Joyner Lucas song, "I'm Not a Racist," the Columbus police killing of Tyree King, a 13-year-old boy and a Pee Wee football teammate. I've had circles where my students of color vent angrily about the injustice around them. They talk about the way restaurant guests avoid touching their black skin when they return a receipt at their job, the racist things other teachers say, and they start sentences with things like, "No offense, Ms. Brandt, but I just really don't like white people because," and it's not my job to say, "Not all white people." It's not my job to tell them that they're misinterpreting what the other teacher said, or that they're imagining things. It's my job to listen. It's my job to listen and to respect their words and experiences. It's my job to model that listening behavior for the white students in the class, and it's my job to continue to create space for their voices. Okay, so it was the 2nd or 3rd week of school this year, and we were having a circle about community, what responsibilities we each have to our school community, what we value about it, what we would change. This was middle school. After 6 students in a row joked about how gross the school lunch is, and that's their number one priority for change, a fairly introverted, quiet student got the talking piece. She began speaking about her experience in Guatemala when she was younger, seeing other children starving on the streets, and described how angry it makes her to see her classmates make a big show of throwing away their disgusting lunches uneaten, because she knows some of the students who do that don't have enough food at home, but they're too ashamed to eat the school lunch because of the way the other kids act. These listening circles have a powerful way of helping us see the humanity in one another, even for middle schoolers. You should have seen the reaction in that room. This is powerful even for adults. It's very easy to get swept up in the "my classroom, my rules" mentality and to use that to win an argument. But that argument has incredibly serious consequences, especially for students of color. I'm quoting now from Ijeoma Oluo's newly released book, which I highly recommend, especially if you're still relatively new to exploring white supremacy culture. The book is called "So You Want to Talk About Race." And in it, Oluo writes, "Black students make up only 16% of our school populations, and yet 31% of students who are suspended and 40% of students who are expelled are black. Black students are 3.5 times more likely to be suspended than white students. 70% of students who are arrested in school and referred to law enforcement are black. When I look at these numbers, there are 2 possible explanations. I can assume that our black and brown children are violent, disruptive, unpredictable future criminals who are not deserving of the same access to education as white children. Or I can assume that the school system is marginalizing, criminalizing, and otherwise failing our Black and brown kids in large numbers. In 2011, Oakland Unified School District veered away from the traditional disciplinary approach in favor of restorative justice practices. They had seen their complicity in the school-to-prison pipeline and mass incarceration and wanted to do better. 6 years later, a coalition of people here in Columbus have taken up their model of restorative justice practices and hope to bring change to Columbus City Schools and the wider Columbus community. Since many of the younger generation here refer to our city as CBUS, the group is called Restore CBUS, and I would not be the least bit offended if you took out your phone right now and found their page on Facebook. Restore CBUS. Our traditional approach to discipline focuses on rules, laws, consequences, offenders, punishments, sentences. Restorative justice focuses on who has been harmed, what they need to heal, and who has the obligation to address their needs and make things right. When two of my students got into a fight recently in the classroom and knocked over one of our drums, I had two options. I could have handled this in the traditional way, which would have looked like this. I write a disciplinary referral for both students for fighting. The principal decides who gets suspended and for how long, based on their actions in the classroom and their previous history. Both students like me less for having done that. The principal likes them less, and we're set up for failure next time. Here's what happened instead. I spoke to each student privately and asked them to tell me what happened. It turns out a third student had thrown one kid's book bag into the trash can, and that student assumed the one he shoved had done it because of some of their previous interactions. I asked the school counselor to co-facilitate a listening circle with me, all three students who were involved, and a couple additional kids from the class. We did five passes of the talking piece with the following prompts. From your perspective, what happened? This is where everyone gets a fuller picture. How were you affected by what happened? This is where one kid said he'd never actually been hit before and that he was pretty shaken. It's also where I talked about my concern over the drum and that we didn't have a budget to replace that kind of thing. What can you do to repair the harm, or what do you need to feel that harm has been repaired? What's our plan to make these repairs happen, and how will we hold each other and ourselves accountable? This is where we make a plan to talk things out when we're upset, that sort of thing. That second process takes me much more time, and it takes all of us much more effort at the outset, but the payoffs are incalculable. Now, I'm not saying restorative justice has turned my classroom into some sort of utopia where everyone humbly acknowledges their wrongdoings, makes immediate reparations. I'm not saying that I have found the magical key to teaching inner city youth. But I am saying my students and I see the value in trying to really understand each other and hear each other out, even if we struggle moment to moment. And that's made my life so much more enjoyable. Lately, I've found myself finding ways to incorporate restorative practices into misunderstandings with family members, disagreements on the internet, you name it. When someone cuts me off in traffic, I spontaneously imagine sitting next to them in a circle, listening to them vent about the awful day they've been having. Rather than clinging to self-righteous anger, I can more readily see my husband's side in a parenting disagreement. I have this cousin, a helicopter mechanic in Alaska, whose political views could not be more different from mine. My siblings unfollowed him on Facebook ages ago. For those of you who aren't social media savvy, that means they've opted out of seeing his latest post praising the president's refreshing honesty or whatever. Even though his posts raise my blood pressure, I don't want to hide from them. I also don't want to engage in a pointless battle back and forth online that goes nowhere. I want to see his post, gently fact check when I just can't stand it, and keep the conversation open. Last weekend, he posted something incredibly racist, which he later admitted he had just done to bait me into a conversation. And rather than go back and forth on Facebook and get nowhere, we found half an hour to video chat. I approached it the way I approached listening circles in my classroom. If I had broken in every time he said something inaccurate or bigoted, we would have gotten nowhere. In fact, partway through our conversation, he said he'd never talked this long with a liberal without the conversation going off the rails. I had to let a lot of stuff slide, a lot. But he also asked a lot of questions. Things like, so what's this Black Lives Matter thing about? Tell me about this DACA stuff. And what's with the pink hats? And he listened to my answers, including my answer about many women of color viewing the pink hat as another symbol of oppression, which is something many of us women's marchers haven't listened to enough this year. And as hard as it was to sift through his way of speaking, I had the opportunity to listen to my cousin's experiences. Working long hours in dangerous conditions, he's worked very hard in physical therapy to regain the use of his right hand after a helicopter crash and severe frostbite from exposure. He puts his physical well-being at risk every time he goes to work, every time. I can see why self-determination is one of his core values. Now that I've talked to him a little, my perspective has widened, and his has as well. I think we're both open to talking and listening to each other again. And I'd much rather trudge slowly through this process with him, knowing we're both inching closer toward understanding someone else's perspective, than simply unfollow him on Facebook and avoid politics at our next family wedding. I'm full of impatience, don't get me wrong. I wish I could just blast him with facts, statistics, my bleeding heart liberal truth, and have him immediately see the error of his ways. But that's not gonna happen. And if I ignore his boasts, how much harm might he and I both do to his Black coworker, his undocumented neighbor, his daughter who might someday need an abortion? My ability to unfollow, to ignore, to deny, is just another benefit of my white, upper middle class, educated privilege. We need to dive in, have these conversations, walk on these journeys with each other. We need to face the pain that we've caused others and try to do better. Can you imagine what it would be like to sit down with your coworkers or family members or neighbors or another member of our beloved congregation and open a can of worms together? An old conflict that's never fully healed. Something new brewing below the surface that no one has yet had the courage to voice. What would it be like to raise these questions and really hear each other's answers? Start wherever you'd like and tell us what happened from your perspective. How have you been affected by what's happened or what is happening? What can you do to repair the harm? What do you need from others to feel that that harm has been repaired? What's our plan to make those repairs happen, and how will we hold each other and ourselves accountable? This process has fundamentally changed the way my students and I are in community together. We see each other more fully, interact more patiently most of the time, and it's beginning to alter the way I interact with the world. It's been incredibly powerful, and I would love to have you join me. I hardly ever give homework in my classroom, but I'm about to give you an optional assignment. First UU is offering a 6-week series called Families Working for Justice, which will bring in community leaders to offer intergenerational ways to get involved in justice work here in Columbus. That starts this Saturday at 10 o'clock. Restore CBUS has a training February 10th and 11th, a summit in April, and another training in May. If you're an educator, direct service provider, young adult, or you're someone else who would like to get more involved in shifting the culture of the justice system, please think about coming. And I hope all of you, all of us, will find an opportunity in the next few days to react to a conflict in a restorative way, a way that focuses not on the broken rule, but on accountability and repairing the harm.